I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As international aid pours into Haiti, the situation there is getting more desperate because aid workers are having difficulty getting help to people who need it. The World Food Program's damaged warehouse has been looted, and in a chaotic scene at the airport in Port-au-Prince, 160 U.S. citizens, some of whom said they hadn't eaten in 3 days, desperately waved their passports at U.S. soldiers trying to sort non-Americans out of the crowd. Stefano Zanini is chief doctor on the ground for the aid group Doctors Without Borders. Yes, it is chaotic, he says, but he's optimistic because his group has enough medical supplies and more doctors on the way.
We have thousands of people in our courtyard. They need immediate surgical intervention. But as far as we are able to treat them, to stabilize them, things, I think, will improve.
Well, let's just take a step back for a moment to look at how Haiti's relationship with the United States has affected Haiti's political situation. Glenn Kessler writes about that in today's Washington Post. Glenn, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
So, Glenn, you quote Paul Farmer. He's deputy UN envoy to Haiti and also founder of Partners in Health. And you quote him as saying that the two countries have been uneasy neighbors over the past two centuries. And more recently, Haiti's political system has been very volatile, to put it mildly. On the other hand, the U.S. policy towards Haiti has been very inconsistent. So what do you think that kind of volatile, inconsistent combination has done to the relationship between these two countries?
Well, it's been fractured. The Haitian political system is very complex, difficult. It's gone through tremendous twists and turns over the last few decades. And at the same time, Haiti has been a political football between Democrats and Republicans in Washington. So U.S. policy veered from, you know, supporting President Aristide to the point that President Clinton used troops to put him back into power, to a period under the Bush administration where they didn't really like him very much and didn't do all that much when he was ousted in a violent rebellion. And between those two poles of what Washington thought of the leadership in Haiti, Haiti was left very much to itself.
To what degree is the United States' inconsistency responsible for the political dysfunction in Haiti?
Well, I mean, that's one of those chicken or egg type questions. I mean, it certainly didn't help. Haiti, of course, was emerging at this time from decades of a brutal dictatorship. It has all sorts of problems, none of which you can pin on the United States, increase in HIV/AIDS, the terrible unemployment there. But what it meant is that the largest and most powerful country in the world was an inconsistent partner, and that has made it difficult for society that was already under tremendous stress to figure out how to manage itself.
And we should note that Haiti is, of course, the second oldest republic in the Western Hemisphere. And even in 1805, when the country was founded, the United States was more than a little reluctant to recognize Haiti. Fast forward 200 years to today, and you report that Haiti's current president, René Préval, has had something of a calming influence politically, but at the same time, he's had to deal with unrelenting natural disasters. They had astounding four hurricanes in 2008 and now this earthquake. So do you see, ironically, amongst this latest disaster, a potential opportunity for Haiti with Préval and the United States with President Obama to sort of restart their relationship?
Yes, that's certainly the bright side of this tragedy, if one can look for one. Tourism was starting to come back to Haiti, and the airport, which is now badly damaged, the airport had recently been expanded and improved. They had an investor conference recently, and the Soros Foundation was going to make a big investment. And so the groundwork had been laid, in part because of the efforts of former President Clinton and his wife, Secretary of State Clinton, to really build on the calming influence that the current president has brought to Haiti. If you start from that base and say, all right, now we can completely rebuild the capital with real building codes and rebuild the government with functioning ministries, just start from scratch and we have a real commitment on the part of the United States, that provides possibilities. Though, of course, you have to first get past this humanitarian disaster and you're talking many, many years down the road, the fruits of that effort will be apparent.
Glenn Kessler is senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, if you want to help in Haiti, all you have to do is pick up your cell phone and text the word Haiti to the Red Cross. You donate $10, which will appear on your next bill. Or you could text YELE to Wyclef Jean's Yele Haiti Foundation. Joining us is Albert Angel. He's head of Give on the Go, the company coordinating with Yele Haiti. And Albert, the Red Cross has told us that they've raised some $7 million through texting. You've raised around $2 million. So is this amount of text-based giving more than you've seen in the past?
Oh, yeah. Mobile giving was introduced somewhere in 2008. And for that entire year, all application service providers and all charities combined raised just under $1 million. And that's roughly the figure that we raised in 24 hours on behalf of one client in one disaster situation.
So how much do you take out of each donation to cover your own costs and profits?
In the ordinary context, not involving a disaster, it would be between 5 and 10% depending on volume. Mm-hmm. However, in this context, we're going to eliminate the profit margin on that so that it'll probably end up being closer to 2 or 3% when everything's said and done. Mm.
The FBI has issued warnings that some of these text-based giving plans may be scams. So for people who are interested in, you know, sending money over their cell phone, how can they be sure that they're sending it to a legitimate organization?
It's a very good point, and consumers should always be aware. But you'll take some comfort in knowing that the Mobile Giving Foundation, which is the organization that regulates and authorizes application service providers like myself, takes time to carefully vet not only each and every charity, but also the handful of application service providers that are allowed to manage the process. That's not to say that a company who has not been authorized cannot solicit donations using a mobile channel, but in today's environment, which is so hypervigilant, the likelihood that that company would be found out in a matter of hours is quite high.
Albert Angel, he's founder and CEO of Give on the Go. It's the group working with Wyclef Jean's Yele Haiti Foundation to raise money through text messaging. Albert, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Quote, "It has been clear how poor business judgments we have made have affected Main Street." That was Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan. He and fellow Wall Street CEOs faced the Independent Financial Crisis Investigation Commission on Capitol Hill this week. And the CEOs admitted that, yes, there have been mistakes, excesses of confidence and complacency even. Yesterday, heads of federal regulatory agencies also admitted that, yes, there had been mistakes and failures of oversight and regulation. So a bumper crop of mea culpas, but recommended solutions? Well, with us is Justin Fox, editor-at-large for Time magazine. He also writes the Curious Capitalist blog for Time.com. Justin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to dive into the specifics here shortly, but I was just wondering if you could step back and give me your overall impression so far.
Tuning in to watch the very beginning of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission when they're talking to the four bankers, I was really – it made me happy because it was people asking real questions, not purely grandstanding for the most part. And so I sort of thought, wow, this might actually amount to something.
Mm, and so it, especially on Wednesday when the Wall Street CEOs were faced with what looked like a knowledgeable panel, as you said, it seemed like
right.
Some of them actually got under the skin of, say, Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs. He actually ended up fully admitting that Wall Street CEOs had maybe rationalized or felt overconfident in the markets in the 2000s. Let's listen.
I know we all rationalized the way a lot of people, other people had rationalized. Gosh, the world is getting wealthier. Technology has done things. Things are more efficient. Interest, there's no inflation. Things belong low. These businesses are going to do well. And I think we talked, much as a lot of the world did, talked yourself into a place of complacency.
Your reaction to Blankfein's candor there?
Well, I mean, it's candor. It's also a little bit of a cop-out because it's sort of, okay, we were all wrong. We saw the world wrong, and therefore we did stupid things. Not so much, oh, you know, they were business practices that were unsustainable that we shouldn't have been doing under any circumstances. And I think that was a little bit what especially the committee chairman, Phil Angelides, was trying to get. Okay, it's everybody was too optimistic. But even beyond that, there are certain ways that your business has worked over the past few years that just don't really smell right.
I mean, Angelides even likened the entire industry to the shady used car salesman business.
But, you know, used car salesmen aren't shady anymore because they all have those guarantees, right?
Which I suppose differentiates them from financiers, as you're saying.
Exactly.
But, you know, another major question that did come up was this issue of banks being too big to fail, or whether or not they're too big to fail. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon actually had an interesting take on that. Let's listen.
Let me be clear. As I've said before, no institution, including our own, should be too big to fail. We need a regulatory system that provides for even the largest financial firms to be allowed to fail in a way that does not put taxpayers or the broader economy at risk. Shareholders, management, and unsecured creditors should bear the full cost of failure.
Interesting to hear a company that definitely benefited from government intervention saying that shareholders should be responsible for massive failures.
J.P. Morgan was probably the best run of these big financial institutions, the one that was at the least risk. To a certain extent, that's him sort of turning the screw against the likes of Citi and Bank of America, who he feels like benefited a lot more from the government intervention.
Except now that we have precedent set that banks are considered too big to fail and the government is going to intervene, and yet he's calling for shareholder responsibility there. So do you see any sort of, is he blazing or trying to blaze a path forward here in terms of how Washington should react in the future?
Shareholders at a lot of these places lost out. The issue is really the people who were lending money to these banks who have basically not been hit at all. And that's been the big question all along, that if you bought the bonds of a bank that the government had to bail out, shouldn't you have to give up something? And there's a similar issue with the credit default swaps sold by AIG. If you got into this mess, shouldn't you have to take a hit?
So we have the head of four major financial institutions somewhat throwing their hands up and saying, yes, we may not have acted well, but everyone else was doing it at the time. Then yesterday we hear from the regulators also saying that, maybe the regulators didn't do their job in properly overseeing these companies. I mean, we have FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair admitting that it was hard for regulators to, quote, take away the punch bowl when record profits were being made. So is the message here that, hey, if you're doing great, we're not necessarily going to look over your shoulder?
I mean, that's definitely what happened. I think that it'll be different for a while because everybody's been sort of sensitized by the events of the past couple of years. But yeah, that's one of the big issues. We had a lot of regulations. We had regulators who could have passed new regulations. I mean, the Federal Reserve, after all the bad stuff had happened, went and changed the rules for mortgage lending in a way that would have stopped 95% of the subprime lending that went on. But they did it after the crisis.
We're speaking about the first round of hearings into the causes of the worldwide financial meltdown. With us is Justin Fox of Time Magazine. When we return, bank regulators were also on the hot seat. They accepted some blame, but they too passed the buck to Congress. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking about the first round of hearings by the Independent Commission set up to look into the causes of the financial crisis. With us is Justin Fox of Time Magazine. And Justin, we're talking about what the regulators themselves were up to. So here's Commissioner Doug Holtz-Eakin pressing SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro and asking her essentially if her group was asleep on the job. Let's listen.
Why is the prudential regulator, was the SEC unable to say publicly something about the genuine financial condition of these large investment banks were at the center of this crisis?
It is my belief that the agency never made a full commitment to what was a voluntary program, and I think that's one of the flaws of the program. The five entities that chose
11.
To be regulated as CSE firms under the SEC could also have chosen to go do other things and be regulated elsewhere and not subject to the SEC. I think voluntary regulation is a bad idea under almost any circumstances.
So, Justin, this question that, hey, companies could choose whether or not to actually have regulatory oversight, it came as a bit of a surprise.
This whole role that the SEC had in regulating these investment banks was the problem is until the late 90s, I think everyone assumed that these investment banks or brokerage firms, whatever you want to call them, they could fail and it wasn't a problem. Something happened with markets over the past 10 or 15 years and the role that these firms played and the fact that there were only like five big ones left that made them much more interconnected and much more that made their failure much more dangerous. And that's what the SEC was not at all prepared for.
Hmm. And it seemed to me that Holtz-Eakin was also driving at maybe a bigger point, that going forward, is the question, do we need more regulation or do regulators just need to fulfill the mandates they currently have?
Right. And I think that's a completely fair point because, you know, we can't have 5 million SEC staffers running around checking every deal that's going on. It's sort of much more a case of defining what a regulatory agency does and then actually doing it.
Hmm. You know, and her counterpart there at the FDIC, Sheila Bair, she is the one who has to deal with banks when they do fail. And Bair had some very candid remarks in her opening statements, basically taking all of U.S. government financial policy to task. Let's listen.
This crisis is the culmination of a decades-long process where national policies have skewed economic activity away from savings and toward consumption, away from investment in our industrial base and public infrastructure and toward housing, and away from the real sectors of our economy and toward the financial sector. We need to examine national policies from a long-term view and ask whether they create the incentives that will lead to better and sustainable standards of living.
So that puts part of the responsibility squarely in the lap of Congress. Do you think that the commission is going to maybe pick up that football and run with it?
Well, I mean, clearly there are a lot of changes in the structure being contemplated by Congress right now. And one would assume that if this committee ends up really focusing on one area or another, that will have an impact. There are these two really famous Wall Street hearings of the 20th century. There was the Pecora hearings in the 30s and the Peugeot hearings in 1912 and 1913. And the Peugeot hearings led to the creation of the Federal Reserve System. The Pecora hearings led to the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking, led to much of what the way the SEC ended up being structured. And so the question is, you know, will these hearings grow into something that important? And clearly in the first week they weren't. It was very broad. It was sort of beginning of the process. And the real question is, will this committee decide, okay, here are the two or three things that really matter. We're going to ask lots and lots of questions about that, bring people back for more questioning, and go somewhere with it. If that happens, this will be this really important organization, this committee. If it doesn't, if it's just more hearings like the past week, if it doesn't get more focused, then it will be somewhat pointless.
You know, I have to ask about the commission itself. I mean, some have said that there were deals made before the commission even started, such as, you know, it having to be bipartisan and both parties agreeing to everyone who's being called to testify. Do you think that those pre-hearing agreements may have actually handicapped what can come out of the testimony?
Yeah, to some extent. And also, I'm torn about the having 10 people asking questions thing, because it's clearly a smart bunch of people on the committee. And the fact that they have different viewpoints isn't necessarily a bad thing. But these hearings this week have caused me to go back and look at the transcripts from the Peugeot and Pecora hearings, which are readily available to anyone at the St. Louis Fed website, by the way. And those were – it was basically one person asking the vast majority of the questions, and it was almost handled like a prosecution. And the witnesses had to keep coming back day after day until they'd satisfied the prosecutor. The difficulty here is if it stays this sort of, oh, we must be bipartisan and we must let everybody ask questions, then you miss that opportunity to really go in depth and really figure out what was going on in certain aspects of the financial system over the past couple of years.
Hmm. You know, and other major issues that were touched upon in the past couple days, obviously, executive compensation at these major institutions, banking practices in general, the question of what to do about regulating derivatives and derivative markets. I mean, they really covered a wide swath of things. So at the end of the day, I can't help but to wonder, could they end up much like the 9/11 Commission, where basically it was found that there was a systemic failure, everyone in part was somewhat to blame, so that therefore, since the system was at fault, it's going to be really hard to find any convenient set of solutions to change things?
Well, yeah, it's like Angelita said, that it's like the murder on the Orient Express. Everybody did it. If that happens, this commission won't have much of an impact.
You know, Justin, I can imagine for some people a major question hanging over these hearings is the question of moral hazard. Essentially, you know, the idea that the real reason banks behaved recklessly is because they knew the government would bail them out, which it then did to a large degree. So how do we wrestle with the moral hazard here?
It's clearly an issue. It's hard to say because, I mean, Lehman Brothers was not bailed out and Bear Stearns was to a certain extent. I don't know how you deal with it because when the world's falling apart, it makes a certain amount of sense to bail out. The MIT economist Charlie Kindleberger had this great line that the optimal policy for dealing with financial crises was for, you know, to persuade everybody that you would never in a million years bail them out. And then when something really bad happens, you bail them all out, which clearly there's conflict there. It can't really work that way. And that's the problem we've got.
Justin Fox, he's editor-at-large for Time magazine and author of the Curious Capitalist blog on Time.com. We'll have a link to that on our website, hereandnow.org. Justin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, still ahead today, an Appalachian woman finds economic salvation in honeybees. Back after the news, Here and Now. In Haiti, rescue teams are using dogs and special equipment as they continue to search for survivors of Tuesday's earthquake. Thousands of U.S. troops have secured the airport at Port-au-Prince in preparation for a round-the-clock airlift to bring in badly needed doctors, medical supplies, and water. The BBC's Andy Gallagher toured the Haitian capital as people searched desperately, and in this case, in vain, for survivors.
So this is my first view of Port-au-Prince in the daylight. We were out last night and saw some pretty horrendous things, but I'm just walking past what I'm told was a school. The building is completely flattened. It just looks like a series of concrete blocks laid on top of each other. I can see personal computers just squashed between two floors, and there are six or seven people on top, apparently looking for any survivors, but it doesn't look like the kind of building that anyone could have possibly survived. Well, this is a heart-wrenching scene here. A woman has just uncovered a blanket to discover what we can only assume is her family member or loved one. She's collapsed on the ground. Two men are trying to help her. They're actually carrying her off. She's completely collapsed.
This is the father who is talking right now.
What's he saying?
He's saying that he doesn't have a coffin, he doesn't have a car, and he cannot leave his son right there because he believes that they're going to throw it away like a piece of garbage.
It's his son.
That's his son. He said, I cannot let them bury my son in a hole without a coffin. That's what he's saying. 22 years old.
Yeah. So I'm now actually in the rubble of what was a school building. Below me in the rubble here at my feet are papers from classes. It looks like a maths class, obviously children's writing. Ugh. So I'm looking down into the wreckage. I can see quite clearly, quite horribly, a foot. Looks like a child's foot and a hand right next to the foot. Just completely, completely crushed, covered in dust. Well, we are now in one of the much poorer neighbourhoods, built as many are into the side of a mountain, and the damage here is extensive. Hundreds of people out in the street, and as I look to my left, I can see what I can only describe as a shantytown of tents, tarpaulin, people gathered in the open air, but the situation here seems far worse than it was where we were before, because these houses were all so poorly constructed, built into the side of mountains. Yet another horrifying scene here. Excuse me. Have you got time to talk?
I'm sorry?
Have you got some time to talk?
Sure.
What's your name and where are you? What organization are you with?
Aaron, and I'm with the International Faith Ministries.
Were you here before the earthquake or have you flown in since?
We flew in about a half hour before the earthquake.
So how would you describe the situation here?
Seems pretty chaotic for a lot of people that don't have anything already.
Have you got enough supplies here to cope with the situation?
So far, We ran to port. I guess there's been just a ton of supplies from the states that's came in, and there's no organized aid yet, so it's just sitting there on the tarmac.
How does that make you feel when you go down there and see all that aid sitting there and not being distributed, not being used?
It makes your heart sad. It really does. There's such a need.
Well, that was just one short journey out into the streets of Port-au-Prince, one of several I've made now, and it doesn't really matter in which direction you go. The scene is replicated over and over again. Schools, police stations, homes all collapsed. The voices inside seem to have been silenced. Still no sign of any kind of international aid out on the streets here. People just keep stopping me and asking me, you know, where is the help? Where are the supplies? Where are the promises that have been made? I think the people here just feel desperate, but more than anything else, completely, for now, alone.
The BBC's Andy Gallagher in Port-au-Prince. There are reports now of young men with machetes roaming downtown Port-au-Prince. One resident says they are scavenging everything. The UN will launch an emergency appeal to raise $500 million for additional aid for Haiti. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. Think Appalachia, and maybe coal mining comes to mind. Tammy Horn wants to change that. She wants you to think not about coal, but about honey. Horn is a beekeeper. She calls herself the Bee Lady. And she wants to transform a 33,000-acre tract of former strip mines into what she calls the Appalachian Honey Corridor. She also sees the project as a jobs program for out-of-work coal miners. Tammy Horn has a PhD in English literature. She's a senior researcher at Eastern Kentucky University's Environmental Research Institute. And she's also author of Bees in America, How the Honeybee Shaped a Nation. And she joins us now from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Tammy Horn, welcome.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So, Tammy, that honey corridor that you envisioned, it sounds like a sweet golden swath that would run from Kentucky all the way to West Virginia. But what exactly is it that you want to do? Describe it to us.
So I do two things. I work with coal companies to reclaim their surface mine sites with types of plants that are pollen producers and nectar producers. And that's a change from previous surface mining plans, which just wanted to focus on either commercial development or high-value hardwoods. So we're trying to get the genetic diversity that had been in place prior to mining back in place. And then the second thing that I do is work with communities so that if they want to have careers in beekeeping and sciences, then that is an option, or if they just want a supplementary income.
So it sounds like you've got sort of the economic arm in terms of creating a new generation of beekeepers, and then the environmental arm in terms of reclaiming all this mined land. And I've read that there's some 1.5 million acres that has been surface mined there. And the reason why it has to be reclaimed is that there's a federal law that requires coal companies to do some sort of restorative work to the land that they've mined. Is that correct?
That's correct. And since that was passed, most of the coal companies really tried to focus on bringing in commercial development because it's cheaper than having to rebuild mountains in some cases.
If I were able to come down there and visit you in Kentucky and suit up in a beekeeper suit and grab one of those smoke canisters and walk along beside you on, you know, one of the tracts of land that you're working on already, what would we be seeing? How would it be different than other patches of reclaimed forest?
Each pollination site right now has 10 colonies of honeybees. And then what I would want to point out to you is that each site is planted so that we have something blooming three seasons out of the year, so that we have something blooming in the spring, we have something blooming in the summer, and then we have something blooming in the fall right up until November. And that is what is different about these pollination sites compared to other places. In other places, we'll have what I call bloom gaps, where things will stop blooming, say, at the end of May and won't start blooming again until the end of July, because that's what we're going to need to set up a good, healthy honeybee industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've managed to reclaim several thousand acres so far. Your overall goal is some 33,000 acres. And it seems like you have contracts with three coal companies now, including the International Coal Group. Was it hard to get these companies on board with your plan?
No, it was a very easy pitch to International Coal Group, especially.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that is sort of the environmental side of the project. I wonder if we could switch over to the economic side. How do you plan then today to turn that honey, I guess, back into liquid gold?
Our cosmetics industry in the United States does not want to use beeswax produced by United States beekeepers because it could have chemicals in it that affect people's skin. So we, at this point in time, import beeswax from South Africa. What I would like to do is to see this region, Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, be able to meet some of the demand for our honey and our beeswax and our queens, because right now many of our commercial beekeepers buy their queens from Hawaii.
I wonder if we could talk about you in particular, because you had mentioned that your grandfather was the inspiration for you to get into beekeeping. And you're a very unlikely candidate for that. You are a PhD in English literature. So how is it that instead of going down the track of, you know, lecturing about the great works of English literature, you became a beekeeper?
My grandfather, he had developed Parkinson's, and through the course of the winter, it had progressed much more than what he had realized. And so for him, what was awkward was having to slow down and explain every single thing to somebody who had no idea of the difference between a yellow jacket and a honeybee. So we started lighting the smoker, and I, of course, didn't know really what I was doing. But we smoked ourselves down, which is what you do to help reduce the chances of getting stung. And then we opened the hive of bees. And for me, I had anticipated, you know, seeing 100 bees come out of this hive, you know, because it did have 50,000 bees in it. And instead, the bees were so calm. They were eating honey on the tops of the frames. And like about three just kind of wafted out of the beehive. And one very gently landed on the front of my veil and just looked right into me. And at that point, for me, it was a lot like falling in love, mm-hmm. where all of your defenses just melt away. I will say this, that my background in academe was very good preparation for what I'm doing right now, because when I go out onto these mine sites, the scale of what I see fits exactly with John Milton's Paradise Lost.
Well, you know, you mentioned Milton. It just reminded me that I think it was Henry David Thoreau who said that the keeping of bees is like the direction of sunbeams. So I can imagine a little bit of the magic that you experienced that first time. Have you, since then, have you been able to spread the word to other folks in the region? Have you made a new army of beekeepers?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The coal company with whom I'd started, ICG, their mother company is in West Virginia. So we have plans to expand into West Virginia. And that particular company is even looking at, instead of having to have some of their crew be laid off, you know, paying them to be beekeepers, so that at least they may not make as much money as they were before, but it keeps their skilled labor force in the region. It gives them another occupation. And, you know, let's face it, I mean, honey is the triple green product. It looks good, it tastes good, and it's good for you. So this is something that, it's a skill that people can take pride in.
Well, Tammy Horn is founder of Coal Country Beeworks. Tammy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
For more information about Tammy Horn's work, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Just ahead, how music from south of the border is making its way onto the indie rock scene. Back in a bit, Here and Now.
When the bees are in the hive and the honey's in the comb.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Traditional Mexican music has never had a problem making its way across the border and onto our radios. Its influence can be heard all along the span of American pop music, from Ritchie Valens to Freddie Fender, all the way to Los Lobos and Los Lonely Boys. Well, another surge of Mexican-inspired pop is currently underway, only this trend comes from a rather unexpected place. Here and Now's Christopher Blagg explains.
Stroll by an indie rock club or trawl any number of hipster music blogs, and you'll hear wailing guitars, pulsing synthesizers, and tailbone-rattling drums. But these days, you may also stumble upon mariachi horns, wheezing accordions, huapangueras, and maybe a snippet or two of Spanish.
Blessing in disguise.
Old Mexico, it seems, has become hip, and its most recent purveyors aren't of Chicano persuasion. White indie rock bands like Calexico and Beirut, and songwriters like Devendra Banhart, are flirting with traditional Mexican forms in their music. The best known of these bands is Devachka, a four-piece ensemble out of Denver with a penchant for mariachi. Nick Yarada, the band's founder and singer, explains his attraction to the sound.
There's something in it that was so romantic and exotic, and you know, you'd always catch glimpses of it on the AM dial, and I was always drawn to it, whereas other, you know, it seemed like it was not taken seriously by others.
Yarada says that Devachka's early days were a struggle. After all, their old-world instruments were being drowned out by Fender Stratocasters.
We used to get, you know, ripped on a lot for having a tuba and an accordion and stuff.
No wonder it took a while for Devachka to gain a sizable following. But the band struck pay dirt when they recorded the mariachi-flavored soundtrack to the hit film Little Miss Sunshine. Now they're a mainstay on the festival circuit and tour internationally.
I think we've sort of molded ourselves into a rock band so we could get the music across in the way that it gets across these days. You know, you have to play in coffee shops and rock and roll clubs. And I'm happy to see that lots more bands are delving into it.
One of the newer Mexico-centric bands on the scene is a much-buzzed-about Boston group called the David Wax Museum.
Nursing a Negro Modelo, I look across the plaza to the church. Battered by rain.
Their record, Carpenter Bird, finds the unlikely middle ground between roots rock Americana and a broad style of Mexican rural folk music called Son Mexicano.
It's late evening but muggy, from the balcony I can almost touch.
The band's founder, David Wax, caught the Son Mexicano bug while working in Southern Veracruz during college.
I was hearing lots and lots of huapango music, Son Huasteco music. That's the traditional music played in this region, which is played on a violin, a huapanguera, which is a big fat guitar, and a jarana, which is another small guitar. And I fell in love with the music right then and there.
Kate comes out to see me. I remember when I first saw her. I remember when I first saw her. I pictured us in Tampico in a hammock on the beach.
Wax became an avid student of Son Mexicano, traveling often to Mexico and learning the different styles and instruments. When he formed the David Wax Museum, those sounds from Veracruz started bubbling up to the surface.
It allows us to write and explore a really joyful way of playing music. This music is so kind of festive. And so it allows us to kind of get out of these certain boxes that often it's really easy to fall into as an Americana band or roots rock band, where it's more kind of a melancholy wistfulness. But with this Son Jarocho, like, we can't help but have a great time when we're performing, and people can't have but help but, like, get up and want to dance.
Jenny, just because I love you, your mama's heart is gonna falter. Jenny, just because I love you, your mama's heart is gonna falter. I sure hope it recovers by the time we reach the
altar.
As good as their more straightforward country folk tunes are, their forays into Son Jarocho often get the most attention, especially live. Here's the David Wax Museum doing a Son Jarocho-style tune at Club Passim in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Jenny, just because I love you, your mama's threatening Alabama.
Jenny, just because I love you, your mama's threatening Alabama.
Tell her we'll need her around because soon she'll be a grandma.
Tell her we'll need her around because soon she'll be a grandma.
But Jenny, Jenny, Junebug, another persimmon tree. Your mama's right, you are too good for me.
There's absolutely a different response that comes from the audience as soon as David picks up his harana and gives it that strum. And when I pick up the donkey jawbone, truly, you know, the people's eyes squint up and their mouths drop and they try to get a little closer. Little kids will come up and start dancing.
That's the David Wax Museum's fiddle player, Suze Slezak. And yes, you heard her right. She plays an actual donkey jawbone, a popular percussion instrument in Son Jarocho music. That rattling sound you hear? Those are the dearly departed donkey's molars. Old world indeed.
Aquí ya me despido porque no puedo más. Aquí acabo cantando los besos de Colas. Aquí ya me despido porque no puedo más. Aquí acabo cantando los besos de Colas. Colas, Colas, Colas y Nicolas. Hey, Chile, but you never got across. No, you couldn't get out of Mexico, but you got it. Now you're gonna have a baby and she'll be a Mexican.
Wax isn't surprised to hear more and more gringo bands incorporate the sounds of Mexico into their music. To him, it makes perfect sense.
As his music is spreading, for the last 30 years, there's been a really strong, particularly Son Jarocho movement, Movimiento Jaranero, they call it, the Jaranero movement. And so you're seeing more and more people play this music outside. So I think it's almost inevitable. More and more kids that grew up in the States and are going to hear this music and kind of come across it just because it's becoming more prominent in American culture.
But Wax does worry about pillaging traditional Mexican music. After all, Son Jarocho wasn't exactly the soundtrack of his suburban Missouri upbringing. He's an outsider. But it is the music he loves. That counts for something.
I guess I'm always cautious about it becoming a gimmick. And so part of my way of dealing with that is, one, spending a lot of time actually trying to study and learn the music in terms of its history and learning how to actually play the music on its own terms and do that respectfully. And the other part is that I want it to come out of just, you know, my kind of love and joy of playing this music. And if I can bring that to more people and share this music with more people, then I'll be really happy with that.
And from the sound of it, he's well on his way.
But you never got across, so you can get out of Mexico, but you got it. Now you're gonna have a baby and she'll be a Mexican.
That's Here and Now's Christopher Blagg. For links to the Mexico-centric bands you've heard, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Robin Young returns on Monday. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a great weekend. And please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Aquí ya me despido porque no puedo más. Aquí acabo cantando los besos de colas. Aquí ya me despido porque no puedo más. Aquí acabo cantando los besos de colas.
PRI. Public Radio International.